Greetings to the crew, members of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to all friends and allies out there across the planet, and anyone else who may care to listen. This is John Lash. I'm speaking on January 15th, 2012, from Andalusia in Spain. The purpose of this recording is to clarify some points in the practice of lunar observation. I know that a good number of the crew members are following this practice, or at least trying to. It is the way in which we determine which Dakinis of the Shakti cluster come on shift each month. It is actually a modern and novel elaboration of very ancient practice of observing the lunar cycles. The way we do it now in the context of correction, in the context of the Sophianic vision story, is different than it was ever done before, and this makes it fascinating. As some of you will have observed, there are particular ambiguities and points of difficulty that arise in the process of observing the sunset crescent in the western skies. And since the observation of that crescent determines the Dakini on shift, it's important to understand how to make that determination as best as possible. So my purpose here is to clarify that to the best of my ability. Given that I've been doing this practice for going on 40 years now, I might be able to add a few pointers. I want to say that I'm grateful and delighted by the rigor shown by those of you who are pursuing this, and it's a great delight for me and a kind of reward, you could say, to be able to share this process with others at this time of utmost importance, and to share it after such a long process of preparation and maturation of the technique. First off, I want to just make a small diversion, a digression, and say something about the observation of the skies in ancient times as a kind of lead-in to our contemporary situation. Years ago, I won't say it goes back to the late Middle Ages, but almost, I undertook the study of astrology with the purpose of learning how to cast charts and interpret them. And from the very outset of that little adventure, I took a rather unusual approach, something that most astrologers don't do. I undertook the study of astronomy and the mapping and observation of the celestial sphere at the same time as I began to study astrology. I studied them both on parallel tracks. And that's unusual because most astrologers don't know a single thing about astronomy. And they have no knowledge of the astronomical basis of their craft or their art. When I was about 17, I read Fred Hoyle's Frontiers of Astronomy. And I was very, very inspired by that book, and wished in certain ways to become an astronomer and to master an understanding of stellar evolution and the planetary system and so forth. So I was set on that track fairly early. And then when I picked up astrology, I was in for a big shock, because I realized immediately that the system of astrology as is currently used, that is to say, tropical astrology developed based on the format of Ptolemy around 150 AD, did not address the true astronomy of the cosmos. So that put me in front of a huge challenge at that very moment. With my initial plunge into astrology, I also undertook a study of astronomy, and on a third track, a study of the ancient sciences of astrology and astronomy, which were initially merged, or rather like Siamese twins joined at the waist. So I went back and tried to find as much as I could about the origins of the zodiac and the origins of astrological practice. And there wasn't much available at the time. Certainly, there isn't still that much available today that's reliable. And I was pretty frustrated in that investigation. One of the books that I did acquire was called The Origin of the Zodiac by Rupert Gleadow. And it's a terrible book, and I wouldn't recommend anyone to read it. In fact, it's one of the few books in my collection over the years that I actually threw away. It was so bad. But one thing that I found in Gleadow, a mistake he made, a syntax error, really cued me to the right direction to go in my investigations. Gleadow begins by talking about a number of things, Egyptian astronomy, blah, blah, blah. And he talks about the precessional ages. He points out, as all scholars of that topic do, that the ancients had an advanced science of observing the skies over long periods of time. And if I would, don't have the Gleadow book here because I threw it away, but if I would paraphrase his language, it went something like this. Over long periods of time, the ancients observed the position of the sun in the sky at the moment of the spring equinox. And as they made that observation, year after year, they detected a shift in that position. So that after a period of one generation, say 30 years, or two generations, or three generations, 60 years, 90 years, they observed that there was a slight difference in where the sun was positioned at the moment of the spring equinox. They kept meticulous records. You can find this in the evidence of the records kept by the astronomer Timocharis, which were then passed on to Hipparchus, who is credited with the discovery of the precession of the equinoxes. Although I point out that he did not discover it, he merely made that discovery public knowledge. And what did they observe? Well, they observed that over some generations, that the moment the sun at the moment of the spring equinox would stand not in the same place that it previously stood in the constellation, but it would have appear to have shifted slightly to the west. That is to say, they inferred from these observations that the vernal point, which is the name for the position of the sun at the spring equinox, was shifting westward. And from this, they inferred the movement of precession, which is a slow shift westward through the constellations, opposite their natural order. And this occurs at a rate of about 1 degree every 72 years. So it's a massively slow shift, but it can be observed and plotted even by naked eye observation. Now, all that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I mean, that's pretty impressive. And so it was stated by Gleadow, and so it has been stated by a number, dozens of other scholars who have investigated the same phenomenon. The problem is that there's a very serious and misleading syntax error in the way they state the investigation. Note that paraphrasing Gleadow, I said, when the ancients observed the position of the sun relative to the background constellations at the moment of the spring equinox. This is the language he used. It's a language most writers have used. But in fact, it's impossible to observe the position of the sun against the background of the constellations. You can't do it at the moment of the spring equinox or any other time of the year, because when the sun passes in front of the constellations, it makes it impossible to observe them, obviously, and it blots out an area of the night sky to the extent of some 30 degrees on either side. So to say that the ancients observed the position of the sun at the spring equinox relative to the background constellations is untrue. They didn't observe anything of the sort. So it's probable that they observed a certain position in the sky using markers they had set up at the moment of the fall equinox, at sunrise or sunset of the fall equinox. They could have looked across the sky and observed the opposite point, and therefore, by inference, determined where the sun would have risen at the moment of the spring equinox, but they could not have observed it directly. I just bring that little anecdote up in case any of you ever decide to do some detective work in that area, that you want to be aware that many, many scholars have made that error. Even Santillana and von Dekkend, I believe, make that same error. Why do I mention this little anecdote? Well, I want to point out that there are tricky problems of observation that come up when you are involved with naked eye astronomy, and that the mastery of these problems of observation is actually the way you learn the method and you become an adept. You become proficient in the method by learning to deal with the conditioning factors of observation. So now let's turn our attention away from the observation of the sun to the observation of the moon. Obviously, this is a different process. It's a different phenomenon with different conditions. In certain respects, these conditions are more favorable to observation because the moon does not exactly blot out the entire night sky the way that the sun does. But at the same time, observation of the lunar position at the beginning of the lunar cycle and throughout the entire cycle does involve certain tricks and certain ambiguities and difficulties. And I would outline them in this way. The observation of the moon in the sky against the background of the constellations is something like a game of hide and seek. The observation of the moon through its entire 29-day cycle involves aspects or moments when the moon's position relative to the constellations is perfectly clear and observable, and other moments when it's not observable exactly. You might say when it's semi-observable, and then other moments when it's not observable at all. So let's start with the moment when the position of the moon in the sky is not observable. This, of course, is the moment of the new moon. At that moment, the moon stands between the Earth and the sun. It passes between the Earth and the sun at the exact moment of the new moon. And at that time, because you're looking in the direction of the moon and looking directly at the sun, you obviously can't see the moon. What then happens is that the moon begins to move away from its new moon position toward the left, if you're viewing from the northern hemisphere. It moves away and moves out of that alignment. And as it does so, it slowly becomes visible as a faint crescent in the evening sky. That crescent is called the right-hand crescent, because if you hold up your right hand and you curve the thumb and index finger, or forefinger, I never know which one it is, you get the shape of a half moon, and that is the shape of the sunset crescent. You can easily imagine that it takes on that shape after the sun has gone below the horizon, the moon is pulling away from the sun, and it begins to reveal itself by showing a thin sliver, sometimes compared to a fingernail paring. And this thin sliver takes the form of the right-hand crescent, which grows and waxes as the lunar cycle begins. Now, while it is obvious, that you cannot observe in space the position of the new moon. You can't observe it in time. The new moon occurs at a particular moment. For instance, the next new moon occurs on January 23rd at 7:42 Greenwich Mean Time. That is the exact moment of the new moon. That's a Monday, I believe. That's a Monday, January 23rd. And at that moment, you can observe that moment. We're looking at an exercise of coordinating yourself through your mind and your senses with events that are unfolding in space-time. They're not merely unfolding in space alone, nor in time alone. They are unfolding in space and time simultaneously. So the practice for the new moon is to observe the moment without an observation of anything. Now let's go back to the initial moment of the lunar cycle. In this case, we are currently in a lunar cycle that began on December 25th, on Christmas Day. And that was the day, well, the day of the new moon was December 24th. And the first day of the new lunar cycle would then be December 25th, 2011. As typically happens, it takes about 40 hours or a little under 2 days for the lunar crescent to appear. You can give the motion of separation of the sun, of the moon from the sun, a rate of about 1 degree every 2 hours. In fact, the average rate of the moon in its monthly cycle is 1 degree every 2 hours. And the youngest sunset crescent that I've seen has been something like 16 or 18 degrees of separation from the sun. That is to say, about 32 to 36 hours, which is really, really fine. It's a really fine, subtle observation. It's a stunning observation if you can catch the lunar crescent in the first 32 or 36 hours. But generally speaking, you set a 40-hour limit. When the moon has separated 20 degrees from the sun, 40 hours after the exact moment of the new moon, then you're going to see the lunar crescent in the western sky at sunset. Now, here's where it gets tricky. And you could say that in some respect, the Nawal acting as celestial navigator has been tricking you. And I do trick you from time to time. And this trickery is part of the learning process. The purpose is to make you go back upon your own faculties. Take what I say, but always rely upon your own faculties to show you what's happening. So sometimes what I say will not appear to be entirely accurate. I'm just doing that as a trick, so that you can become reliant upon your own faculties and not merely taking what I say for granted. I have said, for instance, I have written on several occasions that the observation of the sunset crescent at its first moment, by its placement in the constellations, shows the Dukkini who comes on shift. So, for instance, if you were observing 40 hours after any new moon, and you saw that the sunset crescent fell in the Crab, that the background of the sunset crescent would be the constellation of the Crab, you would say, ah, that's it. According to the correlations of the tantric zodiac that John received, along with the term of Gaia Awakening, ah, Vajrayogini comes on shift, Tantra Mother. Or if you observed that the faint, delicate, superbly, exquisitely beautiful sunset crescent appeared against the background of the Archer, you would say, ah, Kurukula on shift, just like that. So I have said this. I have said this is how you determine it, right? Ha! But those of you who have tried to do this find that there's a trick involved. As a matter of fact, you can't really observe that, can you? You see, when you see the first glimpse of the sunset crescent, let's say after 48 hours or even after 72 hours, it appears right after the sun goes down, but it appears in the aura of the setting sun. Therefore, it has an aura of light around it, the remaining rays of sunlight. And therefore, if it has an aura of light around it, even though you can see the sunset crescent vividly, you cannot possibly see the constellation that lies in the background, can you? So what I've been doing is telling you to observe something that can't actually be observed, which might seem to be a little bit perverse of me. So, I guess I could plead guilty of being a little perverse at moments, but perverse is not perverted. Bear that in mind. So, getting back to this basic exercise, I've been directing you to perform an observation that you can't really perform. But no, not exactly. You can perform this observation, but it's done in a more subtle way than you might imagine. It's not that you are going to literally observe exactly the moment that the sunset crescent appears in a certain constellation. It's impossible to do that given the conditions I just described, isn't it? In fact, by the time you get to day 4, day 5, day 6, when the crescent has grown, approaching its first quarter phase at the seventh day, that is the ideal time when you can see where the sunset crescent stands in a background constellation and how it's oriented exactly to the remaining constellations in the zodiac and also to those above and below the zodiac. You can really get the picture, the observational portrait of the lunar crescent, the waxing crescent. You can really get it 4, 5, or 6 days after the new moon. But by that time, it has advanced into the zodiac. And whereas it may have been, for instance, in the Archer, indicating Kurukula, on the second or third day, by the time you can actually see it against the background, it has moved into the goatfish or even into the Manitou. And so you are involving yourself by this exercise with a very subtle and fleeting phenomena. And the skill of the practice, as well as the thrill of the practice, consists in staying with the subtlety of that phenomenon. The Dakini energies themselves are extremely subtle. Dakini instruction is subtle and subliminal, although it can slam you like a freight truck at moments. It is basically subtle and subliminal. And so the very ambiguity and difficulty involved here in observing the exact position of the first glimpse of the sunset crescent against the night sky attunes you to this practice. It's not cut and dried. It's not rigid. There's not a rigid rule involved. It's subtle and supple. And your mind needs to be subtle and supple as well if you are to learn and master this practice. With that point made, let me direct you to the tools we use to assist ourselves in this practice. One tool, of course, is the astrological ephemeris, which you can easily access online. Use Astrodynes, for instance. Let's go back to the current example underway, the current lunar cycle. This lunar cycle began on December 25th. 2011. And that means that the preceding cycle ended on December 24th. How do we know? Looking at the ephemeris, we see that the new moon occurred in December 2011 on the 24th day at around 18 hours. That's to say around 6 p.m. GMT. And if you calculate that in your mind, you find that the new moon fell in the third degree of Capricorn, right at the beginning of the archer, pretty much very close to the point of the archer's arrow. The archer is the constellation associated with Kurukula. So, following the consistent framework of this practice, we know that the shift of Kurukula ended on December 24th with the new moon in 3 degrees of Capricorn. We're making here the mental conversion that everyone needs to learn between the sign notation, 3 degrees Capricorn, which is simply an orientation number, and the actual visual or observable point corresponding to that. So, 3 degrees Capricorn, pretty much the arrow tip in the constellation of the archer. So, Kurukula shift ends, and which shift begins next? Well, in the sequence of the Tantric Zodiac, of the correlations of the classical Greco-Latin constellations to the Shakti cluster, it would be Mahakali herself, because the goatfish, which is the succeeding constellation, corresponds to Mahakali. Archer, Kurukula, goatfish, Mahakali. Such is one of the tools we use. We use the rimsight model of the constellations. We use the correlations to the various dakinis in the Shakti cluster. So this is something that we have conceptually. It's a tool, it's a conceptual and graphic framework used to support the practice of observation. Now, another tool you can use, and some of you may have investigated this, is the software program called Stellarium. You can download stellarium.org. And you can use this software program, this archonic tool, to help you learn the practice of lunar observation. Now, strictly speaking, I consider that to be cheating. But you can cheat if you want to. It's just don't cheat too much. Don't rely too much on this device, and don't become rigidly fixated on this device by contrast to what you can actually observe and sense and intuit along with your observations. Be careful about that. Now, I'm looking right now at Stellarium, and I'll tell you what I see. In fact, if you want to pull it up yourself, you can follow what I'm doing on your own computer screen. Go to Stellarium and key back to December 26th, 2011. Now, I'm at 18 hours and 36 minutes, which is exactly 2 days after the new moon of December 24th. So 48 hours later, what does Stellarium show? Well, you pull up that date, key it back to that time, that hour of the day, and orient the view toward the west. Of course, I must add that you have Stellarium set up for your latitude and longitude, for your location of observation. So I have it set up here for my location, Gibraltar, or close to where I am. Gibraltar's about 30 miles as the crow flies from where I am. Okay, what do I see? I see the moon shone exactly 48 hours after the new moon of December 24th, which completed the Kurukula shift. Now remember, the constellation of Kurukula is the archer, and following that in the sequence is the goldfish. Well, this is a mighty interesting picture as far as Stellarium goes, because I see that the moon lies just before the constellation of the goatfish. You could say, beneath the gaze of the goatfish, which is a phrase I've used before. And it actually technically might be considered to be still in the constellation of the Archer. But I must point out that there is a gap between the Archer and the goatfish of about 13 degrees. I call it the empty space. It's the one noticeable gap in the circuit of the zodiacal constellations that lie on the ecliptic or orbital plane of the Earth. And so, if I were able to observe somewhat earlier, which I wasn't from my locale, but if I had been able to observe, 12 hours earlier, I would have found that the moon was actually still pretty much in the constellation of the Archer at the first glimpse of the sunset crescent. What I actually am able to observe is that the moon is in transit between the Archer and the goatfish. Observe, put that in quotes, I'm able to observe it on stellarium. I'm not able to observe it in the sky at all, because when I looked at the sky on December 26th, I only saw the crescent. I wasn't able to discern the background stars. However, there's a trick involved here again, because the observation of the actual stars behind the sunset crescent is not necessarily what determines the accuracy of your practice. You have to step back and look at the entire celestial environment and sense the environment. For instance, at this particular moment, December 26, 2011, I did see the sunset crescent here in Andalusia. I knew where it was beforehand because I used the tool of the rimsight model of the zodiac, and I occasionally refer to stellarium to set up my observation. So I knew where it was. I knew it was somewhere between the Archer and the goldfish in the empty space. And I also noted that Venus at that moment was standing in the goldfish. And so I was able to say, I was able to position the sunset crescent very accurately in my observation, even including the fact that some elements were non-observable. But I did observe Venus standing there quite close to the sunset crescent. And the interplay of Venus and Jupiter and other planets at the moment of observing the sunset crescent is tremendously helpful. It not only gives you a better idea of where the moon is in the constellations, which can only be indirectly inferred, but it also sets up a kind of divination moment. So when I saw the sunset crescent approaching Venus, it was a divination moment. Venus is clearly in the constellation of the goldfish, I know, because I can see that from an ephemeris. I can see that on stellarium. And the moon is approaching it. And so what I felt intuitively and imaginatively with this observation is that the power of Mahakali is using Venus to draw forth the moon. It's using Venus to entrain the moon. And so I called that lunar shift for Mahakali. Now, even though you, somewhere else, may have had an opportunity to observe it a little earlier than me, and even though you may have seen that the crescent, or you may have inferred, because remember, you can't actually see where the lunar crescent is, the light of the sun still impedes your view of the background stars. But even if you were to infer that it was more literally positioned in the Archer, you cannot necessarily rely on that observation to call the shift and say, aha, the previous shift was the Archer. But because the new moon fell so early in the constellation of the Archer, that there's a second shift of Kurukula designated by the Archer. You can't do that because that is like a rigid and literal-minded way of following the process. process is very subtle and supple, and it combines several acts at the same time, and it combines the use of the first attention, which is observation, and the second attention, which is imagination, in a creative way and in a free form manner, in which you allow your intuition and your feeling for that moment to combine with what you are observing. And what you are observing consists of two elements: the direct observation and the inferred observation. Now, having made that clear, you will perhaps be willing to go along with my call that the current lunar shift, which began on December 25th, is the shift of Mahakali. And there's a fantastic omen occurring in the constellation of the goatfish now. The presence of Venus in that constellation and the slow dance that brings Venus to conjunction with Jupiter, which is in the constellation of the Ram, is something that we can observe closely in the first 3 months of the year 2012. In fact, the Jupiter-Venus conjunction, which is upcoming in 2012, is a great omen for the process of correction we are following. Having said all that, I want to add a disclaimer. I've said this before, and again, you may have a little trouble digesting this if it seems to contradict everything that I've said in the last 20 minutes. The observation of the lunar crescent at sunset is a planetary practice. It occurs around the planet. And the most extreme separation of two places on the planet is opposite or antipodes. And that is a separation of 12 hours of time. In 12 hours of time, the moon moves 6 degrees. So it is conceivable in some cases that 6 degrees of separation of the moon could put it in a different position, in a different orientation, an overall orientation from the viewpoint of one locale compared to the viewpoint of another locale. So it is conceivable in some cases that some participants in the navigation experiment might call a different shift than those who are located 12 hours away from them. That's possible. And that's possible that if you're living on the Pacific coast, you might call a shift differently from someone living, say, in Eastern Europe. It is entirely conceivable that a group of people observing the lunar Shaktis in one part of the world could call the month differently than people observing it in another part of the world at the opposite side of the earth. That is conceivable, and that could happen. But we would only understand how that happens. We would only understand the deployment of the Dakini instruction in that manner, two different shifts under the same lunar cycle, as we get deeper into the practice. You see, this practice is a tribal and planetary method. It's a tribal and planetary technique. The lunar crescent is observed by groups or tribes of people at the same moment. So all of you who are in the European time zone, or all of you who are in the American time zones, are going to be observing this roughly in the same framework of time. And although you're separated from each other geographically, you're going to be experiencing the same moment of connection to the Dakini cycle. It's a fantastic form of cross-planetary communication that's going to connect you in a group meditation year after year. And this group meditation becomes more and more refined as you anticipate and follow these Dakini cycles. Only in the context of that practice over a number of years, in a consistent observation of the same shift, would you be able to come to understand anomalies and variations in that shift. So what I'm saying now is I'm advising you please, let's observe the same Dakini cycle now together as tribal groups and individuals and couples located all around the planet. Let's agree to observe the same shift together for a while until we get deep enough into the process that we could accept how an anomaly occurs and two different Dakinis could preside in the same monthly period. So, finally, in concluding this little talk, I'd like to express my thanks and delight to Stan and Michelle and any other members of the crew who may have been involved in setting up the lunar calendars on telestai.org. If you go to that site, you will find that the homepage gives you a choice to click on lunar calendars. And there you have December 2011, the first one, very timely beginning, and January 2012. And what you're going to find here is the normal conventional calendar for January 2012 that begins on Sunday, January 1st. But the cycle of Mahakali, the shift of Mahakali, is already in progress and has been in progress for the preceding 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days, the last 7 days of 2011. So this is a wonderful tool, very helpful tool, that's been created by crew members. Love the detail of the crow in the tree. And this lunar calendar can be printed out and kept on the fridge, and you'll know exactly where you're at during the course of the month, and it allows you to slowly learn to convert your activities from the conventional calendar, which was a construct of the dominators, particularly of the Catholic Church, and slowly phase over, if you will, into the lunar cycles. It's quite conceivable that in the future, and perhaps in the near future, telecommunications and other forms of communication on this planet could be disrupted or permanently lost. Were that the case, how would you keep track of what day it is? Well, you might continue to follow the conventional calendar, but you could also resort to the more reliable lunar calendar, which is Gaia's own timing system. And I strongly believe that in the, I sense that in the last two centuries of Kali Yuga, more and more people, communities and tribes of people especially, would come to rely on the natural lunar calendar. You might recall that Jose Arguelles, who talked about the harmonic convergence and the Mayan calendar back in the 80s, attempted to introduce a lunar calendar. I personally consider that to have been his greatest contribution to the whole 2012 phenomenon, the whole 2012 discussion. He proposed and advocated passionately for the adoption of a lunar calendar and pointed out that by living in accordance with the rhythms of such a calendar, we could harmonize ourselves to the cosmos. Of course, in my syntax, cosmos is not exactly the appropriate term. The world system of Sophia's original dreaming is a three-body system consisting of a star, a planet, and a moon. And so by following the lunar calendars and the observable lunar cycles, we would be putting ourselves into sync with the three-body world or the trimorphic protonoia of Sophia's original dreaming. So to sum up, the point I'm making here is that the observation involves a combination of factors: actual observation of the lunar crescent, sensing where it is, locating it or positioning it relative to the stars that you can see, relative to other planets that may be in the proximity, for example, Venus as the evening star in December 2011 and throughout the early months of 2012. And last but not least, your own sense or intuition for the mood of the moment, your own observation, your observation of your own mind. Because the sky is your mind and your mind is the sky. There's no difference between the sky and your mind. When you experience the reality of the diamond sky Dakinis, when you see the hexagonal fracturing of the sky as it turns green in front of your eyes, you know that your mind is a crystal, and that crystal is in the sky, and you are in that crystal. This is a real experience. You prepare and attune yourself to that experience by the observation of these lunar cycles. As you do so, bear in mind that it's not the observation of the precise visual detail that caused the shift. It's the precision of the ensemble of factors in the observation. No one single factor leads or determines. No one can claim that they call a Dakini shift because they happen to have observed, say, a 36-hour crescent precisely in the constellation of the Manitou. Hence, it must be Matangi. Why not? Well, getting back to what I originally said, you can't observe, actually literally observe, where it is at such an early moment. And so you cannot base the call of the shift on that factor alone. So this is really a fantastic art which combines a number of elements, and I hope I've made it clear. I hate to use that word, hope. I've intended to make it clear how these factors combine and how you can deepen this practice. And final thing I want to say is don't do it if you don't enjoy it, you know. The practice of observing the lunar crescents and following the Dakini shifts is not essential to the Gaia navigation experiment. I've said this before. In the Gaia navigation experiment, we concentrate on two moments each month. The moment that the moon is in its... sometimes there are three of these in a month, depending. The moments when the moon is in its transits, its apogee, and when it transits its perigee. For instance, the lunar calendar on teleste.org shows that there is an apogee surge on Monday, January 2nd. That occurs just on the border between the fishes and the ram. There is a perigee surge coming up on Tuesday, the 17th of January. That occurs in the right pan of the scales. And then again, in the next shift, which begins on January 24th, there is an apogee surge on the 30th, which occurs in the ram, well in the ram, ecliptic 36 or 6 degrees of Taurus. That's what we observe for the purposes, specific purposes of the Gaian navigation experiment. But those of you who want to simultaneously follow the Dakini shifts can do so. That's your initiative, but it's not required. Finally, I would say that for those of you who do take that initiative, I welcome you to a really exciting experience. The impact of the Dakini shifts is remarkable and dramatic. And some of you have testified to this in emails that you've sent me at navigator@metahistory.org. Emails you've sent to navigator@metahistory.org. It is remarkable that if you follow the Dakini shifts by observing the sunset crescent and you get it effortlessly. It just comes and it hits you like a breeze. And it can be extremely intense and vivid. The initial mood of a Dakini shift is very, very intense. It's like someone coming on to you sexually at the first moment that you meet them. It's a very intense move. They're making moves on you, body, mind, and spirit, very quickly, these Dakini babes. And then what happens generally is, if you can't take that initial intensity, they never back off, but there's a kind of drop, an apparent drop of intensity. And then perhaps some few days later into the shift, moving into the first quarter and from there to the full moon, you have reflections and intuitions, impressions, maybe dreams, maybe sudden fleeting observations, some kind of divination process that happens automatically in the depths of your own mind. All of these things will then re-engage you with the mood and the theme of that particular Dakini instruction for that month. So there's a way that it develops through the month, as I've indicated by the progression of the Fibonacci numbers through the 29 days of the lunar cycle. And that can be very, very exciting when it happens to you. I invite those of you who are onto this practice, or who would like to be onto this practice, to write me with your questions. You may, if you belong to the forum, Terra Navis, you might want to discuss your experiences of the Dakini cycles on the forum. And it's a great way for you to learn from each other and to teach each other. But bear in mind that I don't always read the forum. I don't have the attention to give to it in that particular format. And so if you bring up any question regarding the lunar cycles in the forum, duplicate the question to me in an email. Send it to navigator@medhistory.org so that I can know the questions that you're discussing on the forum if I don't happen to find them or come across them myself. And that way I can respond to all of you through a mailing to the crew. This is the way I would like to continue this ongoing learning process with your consent and with your agreement. So thank you all for your fantastic vigilance, which grows by the day, if not by the hour, and for the dedication that you're bringing to the Gaian Navigation Experiment. And I wish you all a delightful learning experience and safe passage in 2012.